Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Today, there really is no more important story than what is happening to the price of oil. Now, just like in 2008, oil has been plummeting, catching everyone, including this analyst, by surprise. West Texas Intermediate Crude, the WTIC blend, I'm looking at right now at $58 and a few pennies here, right here on the 12th of December. And the airwaves are packed with commentary, and print media are churning out copy to explain all of this to us, mostly with the spin that the price plunge is due to U.S. shale oil flooding the world markets. And most are going out of their way to even find Wall Street analysts who make the claim that shale oil is profitable at 70, no, 60, no, 50. In fact, I even read last week, one analyst claimed that $25 a barrel was profitable in the shale plays. Now, why does all of this matter so much? Isn't lower oil prices, aren't those good for consumers? And should we see all of this maybe as a gift? Well, yes, for now, but unfortunately not in the sense that in the near term, a lot of shale oil and shale gas companies are going to go out of business because they were not profitable when oil was 40% higher, and they are therefore even more unprofitable today. And over the longer term, we see oil projects getting pulled left and right today. Deepwater plans have been shelved. Capital cutbacks have happened in the oil sands. And this means that future production will be lower than if oil prices had remained elevated. So a little consumer happiness today, potentially followed by damaging oil shortfalls in the future. The shale story, however, is weighing on this, and it's not a simple story as the media likes to portray. It's more than plucky American can-do ingenuity turning straw into gold. To really understand the shale oil future, we need to understand that not all shale plays are created equally, and that within each play, some regions are sweet spots and others are relative duds. We need to know that these wells deplete horribly quickly, and that the very process of drilling these wells creates all sorts of above-ground troubles, including road and bridge damage and airborne fracking aerosols that drift about, harming humans and animals alike. Now, possibly worst of all, is that the nation, if not the world, has latched onto the shale story as if it were some permanent savior from the unpleasant task of facing up to the idea that oil is a finite substance. To help us understand all of this, we could not have a better guest today than David Hughes, a geoscientist who has studied the energy resources of Canada for nearly four decades, including 32 years with the Geological Survey of Canada as a scientist and research manager. Now, it's his work with the Post-Carbon Institute that's really caught my eye. That includes Drill Baby Drill, a 2013 report, probably the most comprehensive publicly available analysis to date of the prospects for shale gas and tight oil, as shale oil is usually called, in the United States. Drill in California, which was the first publicly available empirical analysis of actual oil production data from California's much-promoted Monterey Formation, and the subject of today's discussion, Drilling Deeper, which is a reality check on the Department of Energy's expectation of long-term domestic oil and natural gas abundance. Welcome, David.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris.
Well, David, I'm very excited to have this conversation with you, and I want to help our listeners understand what's truly possible in the shale place. I mean, obviously, there's oil there, there's gas there, we're getting both out of the ground, that's true, but I need to cut through the marketing copy and even outright industry propaganda that's muddied the waters so that our listeners can make some informed decisions. Now, let's focus on Drilling Deeper, your most recent study. Tell us about this study. I want to know what it included, how it was conducted. For example, what sorts of data did you use to perform the analysis? What can you tell us about how you put this report together?
Well, we had access for the first time, really, to the EIA's play-by-play forecast, which were published in the Annual Energy Outlook 2014. And what I wanted to do is look at those forecasts and basically do a reality check on them. So what we did is we looked at the top 12 shale plays that basically account for 88% of shale gas production in the EIA's forecast and 82% of tight oil production. And we went through that play by play. The data source was Drilling Info, which is a commercial database out of Austin, Texas, that is used by the EIA, and it's also used by most multinationals. And it contains basically all of the well production data on a play-by-play basis. So one can take it apart at the play level, and one can also take it apart at the county level within plays. So I was interested in looking at the, as you referred to, all plays are not created equal. And even within plays, all counties are not created equal. So we wanted to do things like, characterize well quality, what is the average productivity by county, by play, what are the decline rates, both well decline rates, which are very steep. If you look at a tight oil play like the Bakken, for example, the average three-year decline is about 85% in production. The average first-year decline is about 70%. Declines tend to be hyperbolic in all shale fields, so the first year is the greatest, the second year is a bit less, third year a bit less. So if you look at the decline of the field, which is really a combination of new wells declining quickly and older wells declining more slowly, you can compute a field decline. And so for a field like the Bakken, the decline is about 45% per year, which means that 45% of production has to be replaced by more drilling in order to keep production flat. So if you know the average rate of production for the first year of wells in a play, it's quite easy to calculate the number of wells you need to drill in order to keep production flat. And for a play like the Bakken, it's about 1,500 wells per year are needed just to keep production flat. So in round numbers, at $10 million a well, you need to put in about $15 billion a year to keep production flat in the Bakken. Production's growing in the Bakken, and that's because they're drilling 2,000 wells per year. So they're 500 wells to the good in terms of growing production. However, the higher production grows, the larger the chunk that 45% field decline takes. So you need more and more wells in order to offset decline. So basically what we did for each of those plays is put all that information into a spreadsheet. So we know what the well quality is in the sweet spots, and we know what the well quality is in all the rest of the play. And typically sweet spots may be 15 to, maybe 20% at the outside of the total play area. So we know that, fundamental law of oil and gas companies is they drill their best locations first. So the wells are going into the sweet spots today, but as drilling locations are used up and the sweet spots are going to have to go more and more into lower quality rocks. We could put all that into a spreadsheet and come up with production forecasts going forward.
Dave, let me ask, so this spreadsheet then, this is at the individual well level. So like, well has a code that's associated with some alphanumeric code and says this is well, XJ55 or whatever. And you had each of those in a spreadsheet, and so they were sorted by, I guess, by time so that you would have, there's thousands and thousands of wells drilled in the Bakken, and some of them get started to be drilled in 2007, then there's a vintage in 2008, 9, 10. So did you have all that data available?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So for a play like the Bakken, we had all of the producing wells up till about July of 2014. Drilling Deeper was published in late October, so we tried to keep it current to mid 2014. So we had every well that was drilled from year zero in all of those different plays. But in terms of making the forecast, basically we used the average. The average production over the first year, which allowed us to determine the number of wells that you need to offset that 45% decline. And, in the spreadsheet, you start off assuming that, in the case of the Bakken, engineering companies are telling us that, well, technology is getting better, and we're making those wells more productive. So I I actually did a check on that for every place. So I looked at the, you know, the average productivity by year from 2009 to 2013. So you can see if in fact it's going up or if it's not going up.
Now this, you know, is per well productivity, right? So that's what we really care about is the productivity of the wells. And just at this point, I need to interject because I think the EIA has muddied the water by turning to what they call per rig productivity and saying, you know, people have thrown this at me a lot lately. Oh, 300% productivity improvements. Like, no. That's a process improvement, because what they've done is they've managed to figure out ways to drill multiple wells off a single pad. And they have these things called walking rigs, which allows each rig to spend less time in transit, more time drilling. So we're drilling more wells. But what you're talking about is the per well productivity, which is what we really should care about, right? Because if we're getting more oil out of each well, then that's yes, there's more oil coming out of the play. But if we're drilling more wells faster, that's not the same thing. So you're talking about per well productivity, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what do you see there?
You know, the other thing is how many wells can you drill in a play? That was another fundamental parameter that we looked at for every play. And, you know, if you look at investors' presentations, there's a lot of talk about downspacing. How close can you space these wells before you get interference? There was what I thought was a really good paper published by an engineer at Drilling Info who looked at the Bakken in terms of downspacing. And in essence, you know, if you drill, you know, two wells 300 feet apart, initially the productivity will likely be very high. You know, it would likely be comparable between the two wells. But if you look at it over 12 months or 24 months, you can start to measure the interference. So really, one well is cannibalizing another well's oil. And the Drilling Info paper basically said below about 2,000 feet spacing, you're starting to see interference if you look at a, you know, 12 to 24 month time frame. So we made assumptions about how many wells you can drill in a play. So for a play like the Bakken, we assumed when the play is said and done, you can drill about 32,000 wells. There's 8,500 producing wells right now, so we felt you could drill four times as many wells as are there right now. So that, you know, that's a key fundamental parameter in making the forecast. So if rigs are more productive, sure, you can drill those locations out quicker, but you don't necessarily get any more oil at the end of the day. It, you know, it's per well productivity that counts at the end of the day.
Let me talk about that per well productivity then, because this is a central part, I think, to the story that's out there. So I want to make sure we get this right. So a typical Bakken well, they drill down, whatever, 10,000 feet, slant it sideways, and then they go sideways in this big horizontal stage. And I guess so per well, how much we get out of a well is going to be a function of a number of things. One, the underlying geology that's just true for that rock. Two, how long of that lateral we drilled. Is it 5,000 feet? Is it 10,000 feet? That makes a big difference in the collection area. And then I guess, you know, are we doing a 5-stage frack or a 30-stage frack? So how much we shatter that rock up, all of those sort of play in. And I assume they've been playing with all of those parameters over time. And so, but you've got data that showed these wells by year. And if we really were, I don't know how you would factor out the longer drilling and the more fracking, but how much additional oil are we seeing coming out of the wells because we've made improvements to the drilling techniques and the fracking techniques? How much is that?
Well, it depends on the play, you know, and it depends on the region within the play. So if you look at the Bakken, the average well that was drilled in the Bakken went up about 7% from 2011 to 2013. So that's a combination of better technology, you know, as you say, longer horizontal laterals, more frack stages, higher water volumes, more proppant. And it's also a function of people drilling in the sweet spots. And it's hard to differentiate the two. Mm-hmm. But as you know, I think it's a combination of both better technology and drilling in the sweet spots. So for a play like the Bakken, I said, okay, we're looking at a slight improvement in well productivity. So I'm going to assume that's going to continue for another year or two. before people start to have to drill in lower quality parts of the reservoir. And from peak well productivity will decline as you go into the lower quality rock. I mean, technology is never going to make up for bad reservoir rock. And if you look at, you know, the Bakken is still quite a young play. You know, as I said, they've only drilled about 25% of the total potential locations. So there's still locations in the sweet spots, although those are running out fairly quickly. If you look at an older play like the Barnett, which is a shale gas play in Texas, and that's where fracking really got its start, well quality peaked in 2011. So they've drilled about 20,000 wells in the Barnett now. 4,000 of those are no longer productive. Well quality peaked in 2011, and it's now down 17% from peak. So if you look at the top counties in the Barnett, they're finished. You know, there's already 8 wells per square mile. And drilling has to move into lower quality rock. And production in the Barnett is now down 18%. So, you know, in a mature play like the Barnett, you're really seeing the fact that geology wins out every time, you know, against technology, despite what Halliburton and Schlumberger and some of these companies will tell you.
Now, I've one quick thing on the Barnett. Somebody said to me once, well, you know, that's because natural gas prices are at, say, $3 to $4 per MCF. But if natural gas prices went back up to $10 or $12 from its current $3 to $4, that people would start punching more holes back into the Barnett. That is that the slowdown in the drill program accounts for that decline, but that they could ramp it back up again if prices were higher. We know price is always a function in this story that's lurking out there. How much do you think the Barnett would be sensitive to additional price improvements and people drilling more? And how much do you think it's just it's past its prime? It's already done.
Well, I looked at that. That was, you know, and that's true to a certain extent. The drilling rate in the Barnett is down. It's down. It's only about 400 wells per year right now. So in every play, drilling rate is the key parameter. How fast you drill determines what the production profile looks like. So in every play, I did at least 3 and sometimes 4 different scenarios of drilling rate. In the Barnett, one of my low scenario was we just keep drilling 400 wells per year. What does that look like in terms of future production? My most likely scenario is the price of gas is going to go up a bit, and drilling will be bumped from 400 to 600 wells per year, and then it will gradually decline to 500 wells per year as they move into the lower quality parts of the play, which they're already moving into. But I also did another study, another projection that said, okay, what if we quintuple drilling rates in the Barnett? If we go from 400 to 2,000, which is what it was at its max, you know, back in about 2008. And if you do that, you can certainly stop the decline and reverse it to a new peak. That new peak would happen in about 2016, you know, if it instantaneously increased drilling rate by 5 times. However, when you look at the total production out to 2040, it doesn't change the cumulative production that much, right? All you do, if you drill faster, you get it quicker. Mm-hmm. So if you look out to, say, 2020, 2025, in that quintuple drilling rate scenario, all of a sudden production falls below what you would have got if you follow my most likely scenario. So, you know, it's there's no free lunch. You can drill fast and get it quick and then suffer the consequences later, or you can, you know, drill at a, you know, what I consider the most likely rate. So, you know, I went through that scenario for all the plays and then stacked them all up and compared my most likely scenario to what the EIA projected.
Okay. And I'm going to assume that given current prices, that we're going to fall below your most likely scenario for a while, just because prices aren't supportive of a real robust drilling program right now. But to get back to drilling deeper, so among the major conclusions of your report were that shale oil would peak in output before 2020. I think the EIA is roughly in agreement with that. But where you disagree with the Energy Information Agency, the EIA, is that you feel they've overstated the amount of oil that the U.S. would produce by 2040 by a really very wide margin. And I want to understand those conclusions. So let's break them down. First, talk about the peak in shale oil happening before 2020. How did you arrive at that conclusion? I understand that you've modeled this. You ran a variety of scenarios. So you're, when I say shale oil peaks before 2020, I assume that's under your most likely scenario. Let's talk about that scenario and what the implications of that are. So do you still see a peak before 2020? Is that how you've...
Yeah, the actual peak before 2020 was for the two top plays, mm-hmm. which are the Bakken and the Eagle Ford.
Okay.
The Bakken and Eagle Ford make up 62% of current tight oil production. And so those are really the two biggies. I also went through Permian Basin plays. But the Permian Basin is, you know, unlike the Bakken and Eagle Ford, the Permian Basin is really... They're really very old plays. They've been around for 40 to 60 years. You know, other plays like the Niobrara and the Austin Chalk would fall into that category too. So these are really old plays that we've known about for a long time, and we're redeveloping them with better technology, with fracking. The Bakken and Eagle Ford are unique in that they kind of rose from nothing. You know, they're true tight oil, shale oil plays. So, you know, I was able to do forecasts for those two, for tight oil. And for the Permian, basically, I just looked at all of the historical data. I didn't actually make projections. But if you look at the Bakken and Eagle Ford, it's the two most important tight oil plays in the U.S. You know, I went through those and did the same scenario based on drilling rate, and looked at the most likely scenario. So, for example, for the Bakken, you know, notwithstanding the current low oil prices, I assumed that the drilling would continue at 2,000 wells per year, and then gradually fall to about 1,000 wells per year as they moved into the, you know, the outlying low quality parts of the play. And if you do that, Bakken production rises to about 1.2 million barrels per day, you know, in around 2015, 2016, you get a peak followed by a long decline. Same thing for the Eagle Ford. The Eagle Ford is actually the number one tight oil play in the U.S. right now. They're plowing 3,500 wells per year into the Eagle Ford. Yeah, it's just incredible. It's 10 wells a day. And I assume that drilling is going to continue at that rate and gradually decline to about 2,000 wells per year as they move into the outlying parts of the play. But if you do that, it peaks, you know, considerably higher. I'm just trying to think right offhand. I think my most likely scenario was around 1.4 to 1.5 million barrels per day at peak, and that will happen around 2016, 2017. If they ramped up drilling in the Eagle Ford, they could go much higher. They could probably, you know, top out at 1.8 million barrels per day. And also, the Eagle Ford produces a lot of associated gas. So, you know, there's a lot of value in those wells. But when you look at the trajectory, you know, peaking in 2016, 2017, and declining, when you add up the production in 2040, of the Bakken and the Eagle Ford, compared to the EIA forecast for the Bakken and Eagle Ford, mine are less than a tenth of the production in 2040.
Less than a tenth.
Less than a tenth. The other interesting thing is that the EIA seems to have underestimated short-term production. So my projections are actually for higher production early on and a higher peak than the EIA, but, you know, much worse scenario down the road. Much lower productivity by the time you get to 2040.
Now, this is interesting. You know, I assume you've read or heard of the University of Texas at Austin study on shale gas that concluded that U.S. government estimates of the amount of natural gas that can be extracted by fracking are far too optimistic, and that shale gas production will peak in 2020, I think they put it, and decline rapidly. Now, as I understood it, what they did is they didn't look at county-level resolution. They broke down all the plays into square-mile resolution, which, you know, some counties are thousands of square miles. So this resolution is much, much higher, and that helps them identify sweet spots from not sweet spots more accurately, I assume. So I'm wondering, you know, did you read that, and how did their study conclusions differ from yours, or do your conclusions match? And then given what your answer to that, what's the EIA doing wrong, and or what should they consider amending in their approach to be more realistic? So first on the study, did you see it, and how do your conclusions match?
I've done a detailed comparison and drilling deeper between my work and the UT's work, and they're very comparable. If you look at the section by or square mile by square mile resolution, you can do that, but in fact, you know, the critical parameters, like, you know, one of the key parameters that you get for every well is IP, right? What's the highest 1 month production, or the highest 6 month production of every well, which I mapped, which gives you a pretty good idea of where the sweet spots are. You know, there's a lot of other parameters that you could look at for shale gas. You know, thermal maturity, organic matter content, porosity, natural fracture density, things like that. But those parameters are not measured at a square mile resolution. They measure generally at a much broader scale. So I think that you can do, you know, a pretty good job at the county level, which is, you know, the level that I took it. And, you know, parts of county. So when I looked at the total play area, you know, I looked at the boundaries between productive wells and non-productive wells, so you could put a limit. And, you know, I only used that portion of the county that was productive in determining, the productive play area. So, but when I did the comparison, I've talked to Scott Tinker at UT. You know, basically, their base case and my most likely case are very close. There's only two studies that they published so far, the Barnett and the Fayetteville. So I did a detailed comparison. And, you know, in fact, they may be a little more pessimistic than me in some cases. But, you know, we're in broad agreement that the EIA is, you know, wildly optimistic.
And so what is the EIA, what would the EIA need to do to become more realistic? Where are they? We know that the EIA, in the case of the Monterey Shale, they turned to a private firm and just did some back of the envelope calculations and then had to downgrade the Monterey estimates of what that reserve was going to be at by 96%, something that you had come to a conclusion long time before. So obviously that the EIA had some methodological issues, or they relied on the wrong parties in the case of the Monterey. But more generally, what is the EIA doing that's giving them these inflated estimates, do you think?
I've scratched my head about that. If you go through drilling deeper, it's a free download for your guests or your audience. I've done a comparison, you know, the Barnett, my most likely case compared to the EIA, and it's really kind of bizarre. You know, the EIA agrees that, you know, the Barnett peaked in 2012 and it's going to decline, but then they have a ramp up to nearly the equivalent of the 2012 peak in 2040. Wow. So it doesn't fit with the fundamentals of the play, right? I mean, the only thing I can think of is they have a phenomenal faith in technology that, you know, somehow someone's going to pull a technological rabbit out of his hat. Same thing. If you go through play by play, I've done the comparison. You know, one of them, I think the bone spring in the Permian. I think the EIA is too conservative, but every other one, they're way too optimistic.
Huh. Well, this is really important because. You know, as I look at it, you know, I see chemical companies and power utilities, all of them investing tens, hundreds of billions of dollars in new property, plant, and equipment, you know, investments with 40, 50-year life cycle horizons. And because they're taking advantage of, I'm quoting here, 100 years of cheap natural gas, mostly from the shale plays. You know, if you were going to advise these companies, you know, what would you... Would you tell them that you think the EIA's assessments are not the ones they should be using?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm so interested in doing Drilling Deeper. And I've laid out, if you go through it, you see there's 20 pages at play, and a lot of the basic fundamental data that has never been available is there, you know, in charts and graphs. You know, let's just take a play like the Bakken, 45% field decline. Sweet spots are getting to be drilled out. We know that they need to drill 1,500 wells a year just to keep production flat. But as you go into lower quality rock, and the well quality in most of the play is only about half of what it is in sweet spots, so... If you had to rely on the lower quality parts of the play, you need 3,000 wells per year instead of 1,500 to offset that field decline. But the wells aren't any cheaper. They cost the same amount to drill. So obviously you need a lot higher prices in order to make that happen. And you can go through play after play and see the same thing. You know, we're drilling the best parts of the plays now, and it's just going to get worse. Down the road, so we're going to need higher and higher prices. You know, the EIA has not only made what I consider really optimistic estimates on production, they've also made optimistic estimates on price. And a lot of the infrastructure that's being built, as you say, is based on the assumption of cheap prices for the foreseeable future, and that's not in the cards. With cheap prices, we're going to see production go down a lot faster than my estimates. My estimates are best case, so I assume that the capital will always be there to drill the wells, and that there will be no environmental concerns that restrict access to drilling locations. So in that way, I'm best case. But even if you look at my best case, you know, that would be rather disturbing to me if I was a petrochemical company or somebody that was investing a lot in gas-fired generation.
Let me test one of the assumptions then, because there's a couple of key assumptions that are really driving the overall scenario then. First is going to be the decline rates of each wells, and that leads you to say, you know, here's why we need to replace 1,500 wells. So let's start there with that decline rate. You know, I was reading this Bloomberg article yesterday, and I'm quoting here, "Shale production will keep growing because the rate of decline from wells has been overstated," Ed Morse, head of commodities research at Citigroup, said. So I'm already reading things where they're tossing out that decline rates have been overestimated. But when I read your report, what I saw was that you didn't estimate these decline rates. You measured them, right? So what's the difference between these? Did you estimate them? It looked to me like a measurement. Like you just said, let's sum up all these wells by vintage and see how fast they decline. That's not an estimate. It's more of a measurement. What do you think the disagreement here is?
Well, if you want an optimist, Ed Morris makes the EIA look like the most conservative organization on the planet. he's always been, you know, wildly optimistic. If you look at his latest forecast for tight oil, you know, we're going up to 7 million barrels a day, and, you know, it's just going to stay there forever. So I'm not sure what Ed uses to make those kind of statements. But what I used is every well, right? So my decline curve for the play, in every play, is all the wells in the play. You know, I looked at the most current 5 years worth of drilling. And I also looked at well decline curves in every county, you know, all of the top counties at any rate, in every place. So no, that's data. There's nothing imaginary about that.
All right. So the you feel like the well decline rate, something we have a handle on, we can model that. We have enough data out of the big plays, the Barnetts, the Fayettevilles, the Eagleford's, Permian, Bakken. We've got enough, maybe even Marcellus. We have enough data now to say, hey, this is kind of how this plays out. Is that a fair statement?
That's a very fair statement.
Cool. All right. So second big piece, the second big factor that I'm always, I have some confusion around is how much oil is ultimately going to flow from a well, which goes by the acronym EUR, the ultimate recoverable amount of oil. And I got to tell you, David, the typical EURs that I'm still reading in the newspapers for the Bakken wells, they just toss around this 500,000 barrel amount. It's a lot of oil. And looking and drilling deeper, I found a table. You had your EURs that averaged 378,000 barrels a well. That's a big discrepancy. How do you explain that one?
Well, I think if you look at was it the Bakken you were looking at? Or?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I think if you look at counties like Montreal and McKenzie, they're higher than that. And if you look at the outlying counties like Divide and Richland, they're much lower than that. I can't recall. I think the Montreal and the McKenzie are above 400. And the Richland and Divide and some of those are down sort of in the low 200s. Yep. So overall, they may average 378, as you say.
Yep, that was your total. So how did you derive those EURs? Was that by taking the decline rates and extrapolating them out and coming up with some idea
right.
of how long these wells will persist?
Yeah, the bottom line is nobody knows how much oil is going to come out of those wells until the last barrel gets pumped.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an assumption, right? You fit a curve. Most companies fit a hyperbolic curve, or some combination of hyperbolic exponential. What I did is I used the actual data for the first 4 years. So, you know, the decline curve for the first 4 years in a play like the Bakken is pretty solid. You know, there's not much doubt about that. So I took the data for the first 4 years, you know, how much oil is that cumulatively? And then I fit a 13% exponential decline after that, assuming the well would live to be 30 years old, which is a totally unproven assumption, but for the sake of comparison, you know, so I could at least compare the EUR between counties, and I used a 13% exponential decline. And, you know, that number is certainly arguable. If you look at the decline in year four, in the back, and it's probably about 20%. So using 13% as a terminal decline is maybe optimistic. But the other thing that, if you look at those EUR diagrams and drilling deeper, you'll see I've denoted the amount of oil that's produced in the first 4 years versus the next 26 years. And typically 50 to 60% or more of a well's total oil will be produced in the first 4 years. So, you know, if you're in a sweet spot, you can make your money back pretty quickly. That's, you know, one of the beauties for oil companies about shale wells. You know, the downer is we don't know if, you know, they'll only last for 12 years, then, you know, that assumption is, of total EUR is just that, just an assumption. You know, I looked at the Bakken, or the Barnett, sorry, and 4,000 wells are no longer producing, and their average life is only about 10 years. Or their maximum life is only about 10 years. Their average life is something like 4 years. So, you know, anybody that tells you the well is going to produce this much oil is really, you know, it's kidding you. It's only an assumption at this point in time.
Now, the Barnett's mostly, it's all gas, right? But so maybe the gas plays will be different. But this is the astonishing to me, David. The astonishing thing is this, that the Barnett really started getting drilled hard in, what, 2007-ish, maybe, 2008?
Or the Bakken, you meant?
No, I was thinking of the Barnett. When did that start getting
okay.
drilled?
It It really got started in the late 90s for the Barnett. I mean, it really ramped up after about 2003, 2004.
Right. So, but that's just like 10 years ago. That's when the ramp up started. And you know, the peak happened on that gas play, within a 10-year window, let's just say. And so, obviously, the Bakken's going to be different because there's still, you know, 24,000 well sites that can be drilled. That'll just take time. At, you know, 2,000 wells a year, we've still got 12 years of drilling. So it's going to take some time for that to really, you know, there's plenty of room left to continue that drill program, but it's not forever. And so this is the part I really want to get to is this idea that somewhere before or around 2020, even these shale plays, you know, now are you know, in decline from a total production standpoint. And as far as I'm concerned, because I'm 52 now, that's like tomorrow. You know, time seems to go faster as I get older. So this is really soon as far as I'm concerned. And my concern in trying to publicize all this is that, you know, we've got the data. You've done this incredible work. There it is. You know, there's really nothing to argue about with decline rates. We can quibble a little about the EURs. We can talk about how close the wells might be spaced. But really, we're sort of wiggling a little. We're not going to get 100 years of gas. We're not going to get 100 years of increasing oil production out of this whole thing, Ed Morse's weird graphs notwithstanding. And so my concern is that this is really, really important because so many decisions are being built in this country around this idea that we've solved this energy crisis and it's now in the rearview mirror. But it's really not, is it?
Absolutely not. And I've been on that same theme there, Chris, for many years. You know, corporations tend to think about the next couple of quarters. You know, politicians may think about the next election. But this is, an energy plan, an energy sustainability plan, has to have a vision of decades. And we certainly don't see that, you know, in all the hype that you read every day.
Yeah, if I had my magic policy wand, I would say, great, we can pretty much add up how many trillions of cubic feet of gas we think are very likely to get and at a certain price. And here's how many billions of barrels of oil are left. And those are two finite numbers. And then we would take those and we would go, where would we like to be when those finally, you know, run out? Or you know, nothing ever fully runs out, but we're gonna have a blob of energy that we get to use over this next period of time. Let's call it 10 or 20 years. And then it's largely gone at that point in time, dregs remaining. That's what I would love to have as a conversation. Where do we want to be in 10 or 20 years? Because business as usual will get us to a place where we have a lot of infrastructure that can't be supported any longer because we don't have the goods for it. And this is the part that I get in arguments all the time. People go, oh, but we're so swamped with natural gas that, look, it drove prices down. That just proves that technology will always find a way. And my response to that is, did you know that we still in the United States are a net importer of natural gas? And most people don't know that part because they hear we're making LNG terminal decisions because we have so much that we better just export it. It's just astonishing to me that the data that you have and the public perception, it's still pretty far apart.
Yeah, it is. You know, I think that if you look at the mainstream media, I don't think there's a lot of original research that's done there. I think people tend to repeat what other people have said, and it kind of just takes on a momentum of its own, you know, which is why I was so interested in trying to lay out as much of that data as I could. It's dangerous. I mean, if you look at the infrastructure, you know, going forward in an era of declining oil and gas, you know, the number one way to promote energy sustainability, in my view, is figuring out ways to use less. And, some of the infrastructure that needs to be built in order to give people an alternative to high energy throughput lifestyles takes a lot of oil and gas to build. And, you know, this short-term bounty that we're looking at should, in fact, be used to do that, not to, you know, maintain business as usual to the bitter end and then face the consequences.
I agree. So final question, and thank you for your time, so generous. Final question is, what's the reception to the report? Has the EIA reached out? Has any government people talked to you? Is industry wanting to know more? Tell me about how it's been received so far.
Well, I sent a copy of the report the day it was published to John Staub at the EIA. who's the head of the oil and gas team, and I didn't hear anything back. I sent it to Scott Tinker at UT, and he was, you know, pretty enthused, sent it around to his team. So they're certainly looking at it. In terms of the mainstream media, we really didn't have, you know, a lot of major coverage of it, unfortunately. In terms of the industry, if you look at the industry lobby group, Energy in Depth is a lobby arm of the Independent Petroleum Association of America. They took special pains to write an attack article on it. Mm-hmm. They didn't really criticize any of the data in it. They sort of had to, you know, resort to ad hominem adjectives that, you know, applied to me, which wasn't appreciated. But I think, you know, if you look at the second tier of media, we did get an awful lot of coverage. And none of it really negative that I could see. You know, I think the data that's in Drilling Info is data that's not available anywhere else. This is data that industry uses, but it's not been widely made available. So I'm hoping that Drilling Deeper will have a long shelf life and people will be able to refer back to it again and again. And, you know, hopefully it'll promote a bit of saner thinking, you know, in terms of our energy future going forward.
Well, at a minimum, I would hope that the good people who are running the state of North Dakota would take a look and plot a strategy based on the likely arc of their industry, because it's completely calculable. So they, you know, as long as they have a long-term view of that and understand where they're going, I think that'd be great. So, thank you so much for your excellent and data-driven work and for your time today. I will note that we will have a link to Drilling Deeper at the bottom of this podcast. People, if you look at the bottom of this page, you'll see it right there, and that will take you over to the Post Carbon website and a download. And you should read it. You should check it out. If you like your data and you love it done well and analyzed well and with good writing around it, this is an absolutely essential report, because everything depends on the energy story as we go forward. And boy, the disinformation out there is just magnificent right now. And Drilling Deeper and other work by David Hughes is state of the art. It's just great stuff. So please, everybody, take a look at that. And David, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been my pleasure, Chris.